This is Pete Anderson Witty, recorded by Chris Eldon Lee on the 20th of November 2011. Pete Anderson Witty, Part 2.
That story of your escape from the International Harvester became a bit of a legend at Bass, didn't it?
Yeah, I believe that it is used at the conferences now of safety in the field and, you know, how all the vehicles have to be equipped with radios, no people to ride on sledges anymore and things like that. But I did hear, I didn't know anything about that until when we moved to Devon. There was a couple who both originally worked at Cygne Island. They met down there, and, but they live in the village now. And when I was introduced to Matt, he said, "Oh, you're Pete Witty, you're a legend," he said. you're always mentioned at the conference about going through the sea ice. So I suppose it's a little bit of notoriety that one gets.
Was that your only close call, or was there another incident? One with Mike Pinnock.
Mike Pinnock and I lost a sledge through a crevasse in quite a remote part, actually, which hadn't been travelled for many, many years. And it was summertime, and you can usually see the dwell of a melting bridge. And for this particular time, I was pulling two sledges. Mike was sitting on the second sledge, and I almost realised as soon as I'd gone over it that this was a bridge, even though it was slightly raised. And there was this tremendous woof as it went. The second sledge broke through, but I managed to keep it going. At the same time, shouted to Mike, who was looking round at the scenery, and he rolled off the sledge before the third sledge, the second sledge, broke through and disappeared, and the tow rope broke. And as Sod's Law, that had the tent on, the radio, the rescue sack. The other sledge just had the food and fuel and stuff. And so Mike joined me on the far side and, managed to peer over the edge when we roped ourselves to the remains of the tow ropes, actually, because we didn't have anything else. And I did a quick guesstimate and thought that if I tied the tow ropes together, I could climb down, because this sledge was on a ledge. And I climbed down and ended up about 8 feet short of the ledge. So I thought, well, I've only got one chance here. I don't think I'll climb back up this rope, so I'm going to drop. And if I stand the sledge upright, it'll act like a ladder. I can reach the end of the rope then and send the rescuer sack up, first of all, to Mike. And then he sent, the proper ropes down and everything. We hoisted everything up to the surface. And then I jumard out, and then we pulled the sledge up, and we immediately made camp and made a cup of tea after that. But it took about, 2 hours, I should think, to retrieve it all. But we were very, very lucky, because, I mean, this ledge was minute that it had stuck on. And it was quite a deep crevasse. The blue depths, you can never really judge the depth of what these crevasses are.
Did that change your attitude to the Antarctic at all? That them two close calls?
No, not at all. it didn't make you blasé by any means. I mean, you were certainly more aware of the dangers. Mm-hmm. But you certainly never treat the Antarctic with contempt or think you are invincible, because that's a silly attitude to take. Safety does play a very big part in your survival down there, even in today with so many good mechanical aids and navigation and so forth. Whereas we were just on sledging wheel and compasses and things, and you know, rather a primitive form of transport. A bit better than dogs, but you never. I mean, you realise that if a skidoo broke through, because I mean, when you've no other, if you've got two skidoos, you can rope them together. You've got a good chance that one will hold the other. But when you've only got one skidoo, you know, if that goes through and you're on it, you know, you don't have much chance.
There's a story about the base doctor Ian Levick who had an accident, and I think you were involved in trying to deal with that immediately afterwards. What can you tell me about that?
It was hilarious, actually.
Not for him.
No, no.
But I'm willing to hear the funny side of it.
The funny side was that, I mean, when it was discovered that Ian wasn't around at lunchtime, someone went down and said, you know, Ian had managed to crawl up the ladders out of the old base, you know, 50, 60 feet, crawl all the way across to the base, down the south shaft of the base. He didn't want to obviously come through the base because he didn't know. I think he was probably still in shock and the adrenaline going.
He'd fallen, hadn't he?
He'd done something he shouldn't have been doing. That was sliding, abseiling down the gantry rope. And as the year progressed and it got colder and colder, of course, you know, the rope's about that fat with hoarfrost. He jumped off the side of the shaft, grabbed hold of the rope, and of course, friction on leather gloves and hoarfrost is absolutely nil. And he just plummeted to the bottom of the shaft. And managed to, like I say, drag himself out of the base and up all these ladders and across the to the base where we were, down the south shaft, probably to try and assess his situation himself. But anyway, he didn't turn up for lunch, so someone went to look for him. And he said, you know, I'm in my bunk. He said, I've had an accident. So, of course, you know, the person came along and said, oh, Leeches is in his bunk. He's had an accident. The whole base is jammed in the dormitory corridor. And we decided that the best thing to do would be to get him into the surgery and so we could look at him properly, you know, clear off most of them. And so there was the Chippy, myself, Mike and Steve and Ken, and started dismantling the sideboard off the top bunk and sent the Chippy to get a door. So he came rushing in with the door. We slid the mattress off the bunk onto the door, and then the door wouldn't go through the bloody doorway. It was a bigger door, so we had to put him back in the bunk again, take the door off the pit room, and then take him through into the surgery, and then get the X-ray machine out and the book of words on how to operate it and things. And you know, he kept off any form of pain relief until he knew what, you know, I think JB, John Bradford, developed the X-ray plate, I think. And they were very good, apparently. I think Ian still got them. So we used to take it in turns looking after him. He gave his own diagnosis and you know, how to put him back together again, which we did do. And then he was quite arrogant when he first came on base. Laws didn't apply to doctors, you know, they were sensible people and this, that, and the other. But as you go through the history of serious accidents in the Antarctic, it's doctors that have usually had them. And afterwards, I felt personally pretty put out about this, and I got him in the lounge one day and I said, look, Ian, you know, this was when he was recuperating. I said, you know, you've put quite a large extra workload on everybody else on the base, you know. And, you know, I said to him, you know, you're acting bloody stupid. You know, this is, you know, a very serious thing that you've done. And he said, yeah, I said, I know. And but he changed from there on. He became a very jocular member of the base. And he remains a very, very good friend to this day. But, I mean, there was a classic example where when he was recuperating, he was painting the corridor. And it was fatal to ever ask people what they thought something should be painted, what colour it should be painted. You just went ahead and did it, because you'd have so many combinations of what people, other people's ideas were. So anyway, Leach's was painting the corridor, and one of the Met men came in at lunchtime and they said, bloody hell, green and yellow. He said, what colour's that? And Ian said, you like bloody daffodils, don't you? You know, these were... And, you know, after that he became, you know, a very good bass member.
In his recovery or his recuperation, did you manipulate him at all? Was he...
Yes, but, I mean, we were very careful about that, you know. I mean, he had it, he told us exactly what to do. But he relied more on his own extensions of his body by, you know, having a frame on the doorway that he could...
Hang from.
Hang from, mm-hmm. Yeah. So you used to see him hanging about.
There's one little story which your colleague Mike Davis has also told me, but I'd be quite glad to hear your version. It's to do with the cook and the sleeping bag.
Oh, yes.
Because this was your idea, wasn't it, to try and dry out?
Well, we had the bathroom out of commission for... It was supposed to be only for a few days whilst the carpenter reconditioned the bathroom. But after 2 weeks, we were all getting a bit smelly. And we decided that I'd take the whole shower unit and everything into the generator shed, and we'd build a snow tank on the surface, a melt tank halfway down the shed, I think we had 2 immersion heaters in it, in a 45-gallon drum, and then the shower in the corner of the generator shed. This was absolutely fantastic. It made water very quickly, kettle elements heating the top melt tank, and then lovely hot water from the secondary tank, and then down to the generator with a 50-foot head on it. So it nearly drummed you through the floor of the shower tray. And then, of course, you came out and you got a 200 brake horsepower hairdryer. You used to stand in front of the generator with... And everybody had these massive afro hair
stuff.
Yeah, blown dry in front of the generator. Anyway, I was in the garage one day with Michael. So Mike and I were working in the garage somewhere, and the cook came up and he said to me, could I go and dry my sleeping bag in the generator shed, you see? So I said, yes, fine. And there was a line in front of the radiator, you know, which was the radiator, the fans used to push air over the engine and out through the radiator rather than drawing it through and over the engine. And he disappeared, and we looked at each other for a few minutes and said, I hope he's going to hang it on that line. And next minute there was this blackout. We raced through the base with the torches and we burst into the generator shed. And Jimmy Oliver was standing there with a little piece of green material in his hand, and the whole generator shed was full of feathers. You know, for 10 months afterwards, we were still sweeping feathers up out of the generator shed. But he'd taken it to the side of the generator, and of course the fan was drawing air over the engine. It had sucked the sleeping bag in and taken it into the fan, which gradually chewed it up into a million pieces, and Jim hung on to it to the last minute, but you know, it stalled the generator in the end and left him with a tiny little bit of green material in his finger.
Another episode was to do with, quite a long-running episode, was to do with trying to free Harry 3 of some of its the incursion of the ice.
Yes, yeah.
This was in your second season, was it?
That was when I was base commander there, yes.
So was it your initiative to try and chip away at the ice?
Yes, it was an ongoing problem in that the buildings were getting distorted. We didn't, and all the corridors were, if you can imagine, a steel tube and then a cord across the bottom was taken up by a walkway on, say, 4x2s in the middle, and then the plywood floors just reached to the edge of the armco. And these were getting so distorted, it was dangerous to walk down because, you know, ice was used to get a bit of melt sometimes, and then it'd freeze onto the boards, and the huts were getting pressurised by the ice building up in between the armco walls and the hut. The idea was to introduce air from the south end of the base and pass it over the huts and then exit somewhere near the garage back up to the surface, so you kept the outside temperature, you know, as a constant down in the armco, which in theory was, you know, to not make anything, maybe a little bit of hoarfrost on the armco.
You had to do an awful lot of chipping.
We did. I indented for two Kango hammers, electric Kango hammers, and I thought it's too much for the support staff to do. You know, there's only a carpenter, an electrician, and a tractor mechanic, and we've all got other things to do. So I put a notice up on the notice board that if any of the scientific staff, if they had any spare time, if they could get a little work party together, and, you know, they would be responsible for doing, you know, one sort of shift on ice shifting. And it was very difficult because it was built on a lattice work, the base huts were built on a lattice work, which meant access underneath was very difficult. So the only thing that would pass through this lattice work was a coal scuttle. And we had three or four of those on the bay. So that was the means of getting the chipped ice out. You know, someone would be wedged in between the hut and the armco with an electric Kango, chip, 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 chip. The ice would be falling down and it would be brought out and lifted up in buckets, and then someone would tip it into a 45-gallon drum. And just for interest's sake, I kept a tally of the amount of ice that came out, and at the end of the year, it was something like 2,300 45-gallon drums of ice that we took out. But being one of the two smokers on base, I think, I decided that we got to get to the bottom of the problem of why the ice was forming in the first place. So I went up on the roof with the electrician, and I lit a cigarette, and we watched the smoke pattern, and we found out that there were fans in conflicting positions. They were blowing from one end of the hut to the other, towards each other. So you're getting a dead space. You got the kitchen, which, I mean, no matter how good the insulation was, there was still quite a heat loss from the kitchen into the air above the hut. And this was hanging there, so consequently you were forming tremendous amount of condensation, freezing straight away. So we got all the fans in the right direction, and it never froze up again after that.
Lateral thinking.
Yes, yeah.
Let me just take you, if I may, we've only got a few minutes left now, to a bit later on. I'm trying to work out when this was. All right, is it 79 you went back to South Georgia?
Yes.
As base commander?
Yes, yeah.
Talk to me a bit about the relationship with the Argentinians at that time, because we're now 3 years before the invasion of
Well, the Argentinians. The first year apprehended a spy boat.
How did you know it was a spy boat?
It was just the people on it who made us very suspicious in the first place, because It was a beautiful old yacht, but it was manned by four men who looked like typical yachtsmen. And then there was another chap who was extremely clean shaven, well dressed, and spoke perfect English. And they'd gone round the island of South Georgia without coming to Gritvikan as a point of entry where they could make themselves known to say that they were in the area, and I could read them the places where they could go, where they couldn't go, and what they could do and what they couldn't do. You know, like no pillaging of foodstuffs and artifacts and things. And anyway, we caught this yacht, and they were shooting reindeer for food, which is not supposed to do. And I said to them, you know, you must come round to Gritvikan and make a proper entry onto the island of South Georgia. And we set off in the worst possible bloody storm. I went round on my own with this yacht to make sure that they'd come round to Gritvikan, and we eventually pulled into King Edward Cove at some god unearthly hour in the morning. But after a very rough trip round from Leith Harbour, and so in the morning I sort of interviewed them and, you know, had a look at the passports and things. And I said to them, you know, what are you doing down here? I said, first of all, you're shooting reindeer. And then secondly, you've taken some parts off the Brutus, which was a lovely old sailing ship. They're taking some of the taffrail off it. And so, you know, they couldn't get... When I was down below on this yacht, I mean, they had a better form of communication than we had on the base. You know, they had a fully synthesized radio, and there was lots of weaponry and stuff on board this boat. And so they said, well, we're working for Davidoff, the scrap metal merchant. And so I sent a message to the governor, and he checked with Davidoff, and Davidoff was absolutely furious. He thought there was someone trying to stake a claim on this scrap metal, and he was threatening to sue them and all sorts of things. So I got a message back to say, no, they didn't work for Davidoff. So I had them in the office again. I said, look, you don't work for Davidoff. What are you doing, you see? Because my suspicions were aroused with these people. They were a bit odd. And so then they said, oh, we're working for the Bank de Rosario in Buenos Aires, who are backing him. So, of course, messages went backwards and forwards. They didn't know anything about them at all. And the third time I had them in the office, this chap, Adrian Marchese, he just leaned back in his chair and he said, whatever happens in the next few months, Argentina's going to get a lot of political prestige from. So I said, well, what do you mean by that, Adrian? And he wouldn't elaborate any more on it. So I said to him, I think you're going to have to leave here in the morning. I said, you know, I'm going to curtail your activities around South Georgia, and you must leave the waters of South Georgia. And that night, the radio operator phoned up Shackleton House and said, can you come and tell this Argentinian yacht to stop transmitting? He said, because they were moored virtually underneath the aerials. Mm. And we said, no, we want to hear what they're saying. We raced down, and Bob Headland, who spoke very good Spanish, we sat in the radio shack and listened to this Adrian Marchese saying that he believed that the... two Bass ships were north of the Falkland Islands, and they thought the Endurance was north of the Falkland Islands. There was no military presence on South Georgia. And, you know, he signed off. Oh, he also gave the number of people on the base and if there was any shipping in the harbour. And so I went and banged on the hatch cover and I said, Adrian, who were you talking to? And he said, I was talking to my wife. I said, I'm sure she'll be very interested, you know. The orders still go, you clear off in the morning, you know, and that was it. They were formally expelled from South Georgia.
And that was your responsibility as base commander at that time to do that?
Yes, I mean, I was thrown in at the deep end.
Well, you're a diesel engineer, aren't you? Diesel mechanic.
By trade, yeah. But you were sworn in as a magistrate.
Nevertheless, you're still a diesel mechanic by training, now dealing with
international
high-ups from a foreign country. Yeah.
Mm. But, I mean, it didn't stop there. You know, shortly after that, we had some scientific equipment stolen by a Russian research vessel. Russian research vessel. And the chap whose experiment was stolen, it was only monitoring some moss banks. It wasn't a very high-tech piece of equipment. You know, it was a recorder and sensors and things for temperature, humidity and wind speed. And they disappeared. So I went on this Russian ship and I said, look, you know, I've reason to believe that, you know, your crew or someone on your ship has stolen some of our scientific equipment. And of course they were terribly upset because it was a Russian scientific ship. It was the Bashkiria. And anyway, the captain said, we must search the ship. And in those days they had commissars on them who was, you know, they're still the political officers. He was the smarmiest buggy you've ever seen in your life. He spent his time wringing his hands, standing behind the captain, you know, and whispering in his ear about various things. But anyway, bits of equipment kept returning. They didn't even have the nounce to throw them over the side, you know. They were obviously caught red-handed, and we could only put it down to the fact that transistorized equipment was very expensive in Russia at that time, and it was too big an opportunity to miss. So.
Where did the Endurance come into all this? Because did you call for the Endurance, or did they just turn up?
No. The Endurance had nothing to do with the Russian ships at all. The Endurance I used to use for checking up where the Russian fishing fleet was. Because at one time they used to come into Cumberland West Bay and transfer a ship from the trawlers to the factory ships. And then all of a sudden they stopped and they said, can we go to Gold Harbour? Well, when they were in Grytviken, they took on fresh water, which, you know, we charged them for. And there was no facilities down at Gold Harbour for anything, and I couldn't reach it on foot or by boat. So I used to co-op the Endurance and a couple of helicopters to fly down and see what they were up to down there. And it was a huge operation, but we needed to know if they were using non-selective nets and things, so we used to fly and hover very low over these Russian trawlers, and then they could see what size of nets they were using. And so that was the Endurances.
Well, Dan Etchell says that once you were out walking and came across an Argentinian ship loading scrap metal and using military personnel to load it at one of the whaling stations.
Mm-hmm.
So he went back to base and he informed Stanley, and the Endurance was sent down with a bunch of Marines on board. Is that a true story?
Yes, but it was sort of a bit... I wasn't the base commander then. I'd gone home when they found them, the party of Argentinians working at Leith. And
so that wasn't something you witnessed personally?
No. But I had used the Endurance before when I'd seen the... I think it was called the Admiral Irizar, which was the latest icebreaker that the Russians had, the Argentinians had. And I saw her leaving Stromness Bay. And at first I thought it was a Bransfield, because, I mean, she's painted up pretty much the same. You just see this red and white ship disappearing until you got the bins on it and realised it was the Admiral Irizar.
Mm.
And the Endurance was just down at the south of the island somewhere, and I was talking to Nick Barker one night, and he said, I'll come up, he said, we'll go and have a recce. So they came into Grytviken and picked me up, and we went ashore in Stromness Bay and Leith Harbour, looking for evidence of a landing. And of course, we, you know, no sailors can resist graffiti. And of course, there it was in black and white, you know, Admiral Irizar, such and such a date, which was, you know, 3 or 4 days before. Then you look out for things like fag ends and film cartons and things like that. I mean, there was obvious evidence that they'd been at Leith Harbour.
And you were feeding all this to British intelligence?
Yes, oh yes, yeah.
Yeah.
But whatever became of it, you never knew, you know. It went via Rex Hunt in the Falkland Islands and then on to the powers that be.
You came out of that area, out of the South Georgia Falklands area, just before the
Yes, my wife was expecting Stuart. And I came out on the John Biscoe. And they'd brought some of the men down from Port Stanley. And we left Grytviken, went to Sydney Island, and then up to Montevideo. And somewhere on that dogleg, we'd passed the invasion fleet going down to, you know, the Falklands.
You saw them?
No, we didn't see them, but we heard about it, of course, when we got into Monte.
So you were that close time-wise to
being caught up.
What were your feelings about that? Because you were one of the few people in the business in a position to actually suspect something significant was about to happen, and you were leaving.
Yes, I mean, I was very disappointed to be recalled by the wife. But, you know, I understood her feelings of, you know,
of
expecting our son. And
maybe she did you a favour.
Well, I don't know. I mean, we always laugh and joke about it now. And Sheila said, you know, you'd have been down there pouring boiling tar on them or something, you know. But no, it wouldn't have been anything as silly as that. But, you know, it was a culmination of 2 years of suspicion, really, that came to fruition. And it was, you know, Steve Martin, who was my deputy then, and who I'd left in charge, you know, he told me, he speaks very little about it. It did unnerve him slightly, I think. And, you know, it was pretty full on when it first started, you know, the bombardment of a certain area of the base, well, opposite the base, where they were obviously showing what they could do if they wanted to do. And then they sent in a frigate, and the Royal Marines punched it full of holes as it came in. They obviously didn't know where they were going. Mm. I mean, they tore into a keyhole, really, you know, a keyhole-shaped cove through a narrows where the Carl Gustav rocket launcher was. And the Marines just, you know, pum, 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 filled it full of holes. And then it was like a learner driver trying to turn around to get out again. And as it came out again, you know, they had plenty of time to do the same again.
Sadly, we must stop because this room is needed.
Yeah, that's no problem. But if that's all right...